You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And with us today is a long-term friend of the show, Bruce Carruthers. And Bruce is a member of the local chapter of Veterans for Peace. Bruce, welcome to A Better World.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, Bruce, there's a lot going on in the world today, a lot going on in this country. And I wanted to have you come on and talk about some of the issues that the U.S. government has been involved in of late. So, first of all, before we get to that, though, let me ask you about Veterans for Peace, in case there are people listening who aren't familiar with it. Tell us about the organization.
Veterans for Peace is a veterans organization, also has associate members who are not veterans, whose primary focus is to encourage settlement of conflicts through diplomacy rather than through arms. So it encourages Congress, the president, other people to try to tap diplomatic solutions. It also is involved in progressive movements. So for example, there is a climate change program or project. There's also a deported veterans project. There's people who are dedicated to opposing the production of arms. So it's generally, it's a progressive group composed of veterans, some young veterans, primarily Vietnam-era veterans who do that. And it has chapters throughout the country and a couple of overseas chapters. Mm-hmm. It's been around since the beginning of the first Gulf War and has been more active, I think, lately, since we've become so militarized. And you know, the U.S. has some 700 bases overseas, and we've been involved in conflicts constantly. So that is the main mission of it. And then the part that I've been really involved in is called Save Our VA, which is an attempt to halt and reverse privatization of VA healthcare.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up, and I've got some questions for you related to that a little bit later on in the show. Why don't you tell me about your background and how you came to be involved with Veterans for Peace.
Okay, I'm an Army Vietnam veteran. I was in Vietnam from 67 to 68. After I got out of the Army, I went to graduate school at Syracuse University and got a master's in sociology, then started working for the VA, and I worked for the VA for 30 years. I half my career in human resources and half of it in healthcare management. I worked at 10 different VA facilities all across the country, including a three-year stint in central office in Washington, D.C. I became involved in Veterans for Peace for two reasons. The primary reason was concern over militarization of this country and our involvement in foreign conflicts. I mean, for me, the Vietnam War was a real wake-up call. To some extent, I bought into the myth that in Vietnam we were trying to promote democracy and oppose an authoritarian rule, but I wasn't there very long before I realized that wasn't really the case at all. It amounted to a blood sport by men who, grown men, adults who should have known better. So that was part of my motivation. And then shortly after I joined Veterans for Peace, I became involved in the Save Our VA campaign. Number one, because I'm a veteran and I use the VA healthcare services. And second, because I'm a retired VA employee and I understand how important VA healthcare is how good it is and how dedicated the people who work for it is, how important it is for veterans.
When you look at the VA administration these days, what's your impression compared to when you were working for them?
It's almost night and day. I mean, this administration, and we talk about later some of the threats to the VA, appears to me to be determined to undermine the VA. I think their tactic is to keep shifting care and resources away from the VA until it becomes the organization they claim it is. Underfund it so much that it can't provide quality care, and then say, look, it isn't any good because it's not providing the kind of care that veterans need. I mean, it'd be like if you bought an automobile and never had it serviced and it failed, and you'd say, well, look, I knew this car was no good, but you never took care of it, so you can't really blame the manufacturer of the car. I think these people, Secretary Collins and the people who work for him, are really, if you've looked at Project 2025, when it looks at the VA, their determination is really to undermine the VA and to privatize VA healthcare services into the private sector. And they've done a lot for that and have been fairly successful.
Let me ask you a few more questions about Veterans for Peace. Are the different chapters, you mentioned there are a lot of chapters around this country and a few overseas, do they tend to focus on the same sorts of root issues, or is each chapter different in terms of what they want to focus their energy on?
Well, overall, I think they're all focused on the message of peace and diplomatic solutions, but different chapters, depending on where they're located. For example, the San Diego chapter is very involved in deported veterans because so many veterans who deported went to Mexico. And one of their main focuses is to try to get these people returned to the United States. Other ones, depending where they're located, if they're near a large military base or a plant that provides military equipment, they might be more concerned with trying to reduce the size of the military, trying to stop production of arms weapons. So they have the same mission, but a lot of it depends on the membership and where they're located. It is a democratically organized organization, and each chapter is free in many ways to pursue the parts of Veterans for Peace that it's most interested in.
Mm-hmm. Do you work with other peace organizations, either locally or nationally?
We do on it's kind of an ad hoc basis. You know, there are groups in Asheville that we'll coordinate with them on various programs that they put on. So we do work with them. And the national level works with other organizations. For example, with Common Defense, it's a large progressive veterans organization. There's a lot of younger members in, and there's cooperation with Veterans for Peace, not Veterans for Peace, for Common Defense, for example.
So you mentioned about serving in the Vietnam War. Did you come out of that physically unscathed, or did you have any health issues related to, like Agent Orange, anything like that?
I do have two conditions related to Agent Orange. I have a cardiac condition. I had bypass surgery in September of 2013, and this past summer, I went through radiation for prostate cancer, both of which are related to exposure to Agent Orange. Mm-hmm. Where I was stationed in Benoit, two of the main places where Agent Orange was stored and then loaded on planes to be sprayed. So in Benoit now, the groundwater and the soil is completely saturated with Agent Orange, and there are tens of thousands of Vietnamese in that area that have suffered birth defects, cancers, and other things from the result of it. So when I got back without physical injury, but those have appeared later in my life.
What's kind of, have you talked to other veterans as well who have suffered from the effects of Agent Orange, and what's your and what's their attitude about that situation and the use of that chemical? And did they, I've talked to a couple of veterans in the past who, I mean, to be honest, they just felt betrayed by what happened to them.
Yes, I have people from my hometown who served in Vietnam. One of my good friends has also undergone radiation for prostate cancer, and a good friend of mine in Veterans for Peace is currently undergoing radiation for that. The attitude of the people I know and I've talked to is that it was a crime to spray Agent Orange. I mean, it's a toxic chemical. To spray it freely all over the country on not just U.S. Servicemen, but South Vietnamese allies and civilians was an absolute crime. It was finally stopped, but I mean, there was no excuse for it. Mm-hmm. So I think most veterans that I know view this as an immoral activity by the United States in pursuing the war.
Yeah. I mean, I've even read where there are cases where not just the veteran might be suffering ill effects from it, but also perhaps their offspring.
Yeah, burst effects. Yeah, burst effects are not uncommon among veterans who are exposed to Agent Orange. So for some people, Agent Orange was sprayed right in areas they worked or occasionally right on top of them. So their exposure was great. I mean, where I was, it was around, in 67 was one of the big periods for Agent Orange. So it was around all the time. So you're right, there are burst effects besides personal effects on servicemen. There are also burst effects on their family.
So let me ask you, if we could kind of switch gears just a little bit, let me ask you about some of the situations that the U.S. has been involved in fairly recently and get your opinion, or if Veterans for Peace has taken a stance on any of these things. The U.S. government lately has taken action in Venezuela, the attack on what the government has called drug boat runners, and then the going into Venezuela and taking President Maduro. Could you share your thoughts about what the U.S. has been doing there, what we're up to?
Yeah, so if we take the boats first, there's no proof that any of these boats were carrying drugs. And it's my understanding from what I've read, this is something the Coast Guard would take care of. They would interdict these boats, and if there were people who were transporting drugs, they would be held accountable under the law. So this wholesale destruction of these boats without any proof that they're carrying drugs and without any due process, again, I think is an illegal criminal act by the government. A telling example is there were some survivors from one of these attacks, and rather than taking them in, they'd killed them, or in another case, I think they returned them to Venezuela. If they were really interested in discovering what was going on, I think they would have tried to bring these people to interrogate them to find out how and who were moving these drugs. So it's just, it's kind of a rogue action, I think. I'm not really sure what the intent is. Sometimes I think it's more just to show that the people who are running the government are tough rather than really trying to interdict mm-hmm. drugs.
Is this something that just started under the current administration, or was it going on before?
I think the Coast Guard has been trying to interdict these boats for a long time because of drugs being smuggled into the U.S. This having the military destroy these boats, as far as I know, this is something new. This is a new tactic.
And then what about going into Venezuela and taking the President Maduro back to New York?
Well, I can say, and I think it's fair to say, Veterans for Peace position is not to defend Maduro, not to say that he was a benevolent ruler, but that it's an illegal action for the United States to go into another country and kidnap a president. I mean, it's hard to get people to think, because the U.S. is so powerful, how would we feel if somebody came into the United States and kidnapped the president and took him someplace else to put him on trial? I mean, it's an abrogation of sovereign rights, and it's not the way to resolve something. And so I think it's just another illegal action. And I'm not sure what the motivation is, but certainly access to Venezuela's oil seems to be a part of why that was done by the current administration.
Mm-hmm. It made me think about all those years when the U.S. government, namely the CIA, was deeply involved in regime change in several countries, in places like Honduras, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and other countries around the world as well. Whereas at the time, those were seen as covert operations, and afterwards, this situation in Venezuela is not so covert. I mean, it's pretty out there.
It's not covert at all. And, you know, we have this a long, long history of intervening in South American and Latin American affairs, overturning governments, covert actions. It's not anything new. I think it's just more blatant than what's been done in the past. They are, if you do any research on what's happened, that's been our mode. In fact, I think President Trump said it's our hemisphere, which has been sort of the unspoken view of the United States in many ways in terms of what happens in Latin America and South America.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you talk about hemisphere, it brings up the thought about Greenland, and was wondering about your thoughts about what's going on with this administration, what their intentions are towards Greenland.
You know, if it weren't so serious, it'd be laughable to think that we would try to invade a territory of a NATO ally to get what we already have. I mean, Greenland and Denmark have made it clear that the U.S. is welcome to expand its bases there. The U.S. intentionally reduced the size of its military footprint. And it's also said the U.S. is welcome to have companies come in and exploit its resources. So there wasn't anything really to it. I can't really understand what the motivation was for saying that we would invade a territory, an autonomous territory of a NATO ally, when we have an agreement with them that, you know, if you attack one, you attack all of them. It's just, you know, it boggles the mind that that was the approach that we were going to take for Greenland. Like I said, if it wasn't so serious, it'd be laughable. It's almost like, in some ways, what's going on, if this wasn't the case, would be a humorous movie that we would watch and say, oh my gosh, that would never happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that agreement you're talking about, I mean, that's what, been in place since the 50s or something, I think.
Yeah, I think since the 50s, since the Cold War, it's been in place, and that's been the use. And President Trump said they only have a couple dog sleds for defense. Well, the country only has some 50,000 people there, and the U.S. had bases there and is welcome to have bases again. So there's no real issue. And he said Russia or China will take Greenland. There doesn't appear to be any threat from either Russia or China to try to possess Greenland.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Bruce Carruthers. He's a member of the local chapter of the Veterans for Peace, Western North Carolina. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. Okay, that's Benedictus, and that's by the cellist Hauser. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina, and we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. And our guest today, Bruce Carruthers, member of the local chapter of Veterans for Peace, Western North Carolina. Bruce, let me talk to you about what's going on with the militarization of federal agents, namely in the actions of ICE. Does the Veterans for Peace have any sort of position on this issue, like with what's happening in Minneapolis and other cities?
Yeah, Veterans for Peace opposes this. I mean, what's interesting is that under President Obama, deportations reached a very high level, but not in the same manner. I mean, we didn't have militarized ICE agents or Border Patrol agents taking over whole cities, breaking down doors, claiming that they don't need a warrant into somebody's house. I mean, it was done, as far as I can tell, pretty much in accordance with what the law was. So Veterans for Peace position is, first, that these are illegal activities, that ICE agents have to follow the law, that they shouldn't be flooding cities like that, they shouldn't be causing confrontations with citizens who are protesting. I mean, if you watch some of the videos, you'll see somebody will be filming them or protesting them, and ICE agents will sometimes grab them, pull them out of their car, push them on the ground. I mean, really violent actions. And of course, we know recently in Minneapolis, two people have been shot. The woman Good, who was shot three times, I think once right in the head while she was just driving away and posed no danger to them. And then the VA nurse who was trying to assist another woman who ICE agents had pushed down, he had a gun with him, but he had a permit to carry, and he didn't have any gun in his hand. He was down, and his gun had been removed when he was shot, what I've read 9 or 10 times. So Veterans for Peace, I think, and many citizens think this is unlawful and an immoral act on the part of ICE.
So what do you think is the way to put the brakes on what they're doing in communities like Minneapolis?
I think the only way that can happen, and I think it may happen, is the current funding bill for ICE apparently is going to be held up by the Democrats in the Senate. I think that strict controls need to be placed on ICE, and I think only Congress can do that. How they approach, they need to quit wearing masks, they need to wear identification, they need not to be able to break into citizens' homes without a warrant, and they need to be able to, right now, they're just stopping people and asking for identification to prove they're a citizen. And, you know, that's not how things work here. The assumption is you're a citizen. If you have good cause to think somebody's not a citizen, then you can apprehend them and ask for identification. But once they've been apprehended, they should get due process, not be sent to an detention center and then attempt to deport them immediately. So Veterans for Peace position is that this is a legal activity. And then some people in Veterans for Peace are opposed to deportation of people who are here illegally. What President Trump and his people said they were going to focus on immigrants who had a criminal record, who were a danger to the country. And I think a lot of people wouldn't be opposed to that, but this just seems to be wholesale deportation. I mean, anybody they can find who they think is not here legally, they want to deport. So Veterans for Peace opposes deportation in this manner, and some members of Veterans for Peace probably oppose deportation under any circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard, gotten wind, is that sort of thing happening in Western North Carolina?
I have not. I don't know if we have or not. I know they were in Charlotte for a while and deported people, but I don't, as far as I know, it never got to the point where it's gotten to be in Minneapolis and other cities.
Let me ask you about something that has been in the news of late, and it involves the senator, I think he's from Arizona, Senator Mark Kelly, and the video that he and other politicians made encouraging service people to refuse orders if they felt they were illegal. And you're a former military person. What's the actual, is there a law that says that? Is this in the Constitution? And what are your thoughts about what's going on with that?
Yeah, Senator Kelly, I think this attempt by Secretary Hegstaff to say, to jeopardize his retirement is just ridiculous. I mean, he's a U.S. senator, he's a U.S. citizen, he has a right to speak out the way he wants. In no way is this attempting to undermine the military. I think the point he's trying to make is if somebody in the military gets an illegal order, they don't have to refuse it, and that's always been the case. It's very difficult for a service member to do that. I mean, you can imagine the consequences of doing that would be you'd likely end up in the brig someplace or dishonorably discharged. I mean, you know, the consequences would be great. But I think this was more to get a message across to people that what's happening is in the military is illegal. Many of the actions that the government's asking soldiers to take are illegal actions. There's supposed to be a firm separation between domestic policy and the military. The military is not supposed to intervene in domestic policy. And I think that's part of what they were trying to make, these deployment of National Guard troops to cities and the threat by President Trump to send regular military units into the cities. I think that's what they were trying to encourage. So I don't think that Senator Kelly or other people did anything wrong. I think they were just reminding soldiers what their options were. That said, it'd be very difficult for anybody in the military to actually comply with that. I mean, the consequences would be pretty severe.
I may have this wrong, but I thought I had read an article where Veterans for Peace has started putting up billboards in different locations around the country with the same theme.
I think some local chapters have done that to support this. I don't know. I'm not aware that as a national organization, Veterans for Peace has done that.
So it was, that idea was mainly focused on the use of military in the U.S., not necessarily like use of military towards Venezuela or other areas around the world.
Well, there are other issues. You know, the kind of torture that the military engaged in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think, is an example of the kind of thing they're talking about. I mean, those were clearly illegal actions because you're not supposed to torture prisoners that way. So I think they were talking in general about whether this current administration is going to use the military in lawful ways. But I do think part of it, the impetus for this was because increasingly the military has been used to enforce administration policies. And I can't speak for Senator Kelly or the others. That's supposition on my part.
So a few years ago, you were on the show and we talked about privatization of the VA healthcare system. And I know we touched on it a little bit at the beginning of the interview, and I'd like to kind of go towards that so we can get an idea of what's transpired since you were the last on the show. What's your assessment of where that process is now in terms of privatization of the VA? Has it stopped? Is it still going on?
Well, it's going on, and the situation has gotten worse since the last time I was on the show. More and more of VA's funds are being diverted to the private sector under what's called the Veterans Community Care Program. So that's when, rather than being treated by the VA, a veteran is referred to a private provider in a network that the VA's established with third-party administrators. Optum is one of them, for example, and in TriWest is another one. And so you can call and you want an appointment for to see a cardiologist or an ophthalmologist or an optometrist, and you'll be offered the opportunity to see somebody in the private sector. It's supposed to be only if the VA can't provide services in a timely fashion or if the distance is too great for you to travel and it's more convenient to do it locally. But in fact, wholesale now, the VA is, when you call the VA now, often one of the first things they talk about is the community care program. So more money, more patients are being diverted from treatment at VA facilities to treatment in the private sector. And there are a lot of problems with that, which I'd be happy to discuss.
One thing that pops in my mind to ask you is, are providers satisfied with what they're getting paid by the VA to care for these veterans?
VA pays essentially Medicare rates. And there's been some dissatisfaction with that, but most of these providers accept Medicare rates, not Medicaid rates, Medicare rates. So, of course, they always want more money than they want, but there doesn't seem to have been much problem getting people to sign up for the community care program. So I don't know if they're really dissatisfied with the rates. Certainly they would like more.
Have you noticed, if you still go to the VA hospital in Asheville, have you noticed any changes over the past couple of years?
Well, what I've noticed is to get an eye appointment takes an extremely long time. And I talked to the administration there and I said, you know, given the age of most veterans that go there and the likelihood of eye problems, wouldn't it be better to hire another optometrist than refer people to the private sector? So the other change I've noticed is that I wouldn't say you're actually pushed to go to the community care program, but sort of offered that right away. And I've often said, I don't want care from the private sector. I want to see a VA provider. Those are the changes I've seen at the Asheville, but my connections with other veterans, it's been more severe in other facilities and maybe in larger urban areas. But the number of patients who are referred to the community care program, the money expended has increased dramatically in the last couple of years. I mean, over a third of VA's budget now goes to community care, VA's healthcare budget.
So that means less care is available in the VA hospital setting?
Well, less care is available because the VA doesn't staff for those positions. doesn't staff enough to provide timely care. Now, some of this has got to do with veterans who live at some distance from the VA, and it's much more convenient for them to see a local provider than to drive all the way to the VA. Although satisfaction surveys that the VA conducts show that about 90% of veterans are satisfied with VA care and prefer to get their care at the VA.
I read an article from last summer that talked about how the current administration was in process of eliminating 30,000 jobs for physicians, nurses, and other personnel. Are you aware of how that's been going?
Yeah, they have already eliminated 30,000 positions. They didn't fill positions. They let people go. They had this program where you could take an early retirement and people left. So 30,000 people have already left, but right now, Secretary Collins has announced that he's going to reduce VA employment by another 30 to 40,000 positions by not filling vacant positions. The rationale that was given for that is these were COVID-era positions that are longer needed. Secondly, that since they're vacant, it's shown that they don't need, the positions aren't needed. That's a false narrative for more than one reason. Most of these positions were added because of the impact of the PACT Act, the NAFTA Act that made toxic exposure in the Middle East made veterans who got that eligible for care at the VA. So currently, almost a million veterans have enrolled for, new veterans have enrolled for health care in the VA system because of the PACT Act. 1.9 million veterans have filed for disability benefits because of exposure to toxic substance. So the workload has increased dramatically, and under the Biden administration, the VA staffed up to try to meet this anticipated workload. Secondly, part of the reason for the two reasons for the vacancy, right now, it's a very tight market in healthcare. It's not just the VA that has difficulty attracting people. The average turnover rate in private hospitals is between 18 and 20%. So the VA experiences turnover just like the private sector does. And so some positions remain vacant. Some are very hard to fill. Psychologists, psychiatrists, for example, are difficult to recruit. And then the other reason is because of all the bad publicity the VA's gotten, because of the firings, because of the potential reductions, the VA eliminated the work-at-home program and brought a lot of people in who were effectively working at home. The last figure I saw in an article published in ProPublica, 4 out of 10 doctors are now refusing offers from the VA. So a lot of people feel, a lot of healthcare providers feel the VA is a very problematic, uncertain situation, are not willing to come work for the VA because they fear they may be fired. So the VA is experiencing recruitment problems, just like all healthcare is. I'm also the president of the Veterans Healthcare Policy Institute, and one of our analysts, Suzanne Gordon, did an extensive study, a state-by-state look at, by state and by county, where there are healthcare shortages. And there are, in North Carolina and all across the country, there are essentially healthcare deserts where there are not enough providers to go around. So it's not just the VA that's having trouble recruiting people. There are not enough healthcare providers. The American Association of Medical Colleges predicts in the next 10 years, there'll be about a 50,000 physician shortage of primary care providers, about 30,000 registered nursing shortage. So we're not training enough people to provide the healthcare we need. And if you follow the news at all, you'll know that rural hospitals are under real threat. Many of them have closed, they've reduced functions. And with this big, beautiful bill, funding for rural hospitals is going to be cut back because of Medicaid cutbacks, and they'll be under even more threats. So we're going to refer veterans to a private sector that's ill-equipped to handle the patients it has now, and we're going to add an extensive workload on to these private providers who can't handle the patients that they need. In some places, we're lucky to be able to see somebody. You know, for example, the standard for seeing a specialist in the VA is 30 days. If you can't get an appointment with a specialist, a VA specialist, you can use a community care program. Well, I know that because I've gotten some care in the private sector, and my wife does, and friends do. You try to get an appointment with a specialist in 30 days. Try to see a rheumatologist. Try to see a cardiologist. Try to see a dermatologist in 30 days. It's not that easy. I mean, you can call, and the wait time can be 6 months. So it is a problem with the U.S. healthcare system. We're not training enough people, and we just don't have the access. And especially in rural areas, the situation's deteriorating rapidly.
You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And our guest today is Bruce Carruthers, member of the local chapter of Veterans for Peace. And we'll return with Bruce in just a few minutes after this break. Okay, welcome back. That's Lenny Kravitz singing We Want Peace. And our guest today is Bruce Carruthers. He's a member of the local chapter of Veterans for Peace. And before the break, we were talking about privatization of the VA healthcare system. Bruce, who benefits the most from privatization? Some would say the veteran does. Others say the beneficiaries are private healthcare providers, or the federal government benefits that it no longer has to spend such resources to run a department like the VA. What's your feeling about it?
Who benefits from this is corporate health care. Studies by the Government Accounting Office, the Congressional Budget Office, the few times they bothered to study the cost of community care, shows that it's more expensive than VA care. So it's not going to save the government any more money. In fact, what they want the VA to become is an insurance program. And it's not going to save the VA any money by referring people to the private sector. Two things happen. One, it's not cheaper. And the second thing that happens is the VA takes what might be considered a conservative approach to healthcare. That is not immediately ordering expensive tests or procedures until they seem to be necessary. One of the studies that was done had to do with veterans who were treated for prostate cancer in the private sector under the community care program and the VA. And what they found was that if a veteran was referred to the private sector, they were more likely to get expensive tests and procedures which may have not been necessary. When the standard for most prostate cancer is to continue to do PSAs, trace that, because a lot of veterans will live for many years without any intervention. They found that veterans who went to the private sector were much more likely to have surgical or other interventions and much more likely to have expensive tests ordered. So it doesn't save any money. Another study compared veterans who are eligible for emergency room care from the VA and from the private sector in how they fared when they had a cardiac incident. What it found was not only was it about 20% cheaper to have them treated in the VA, but mortality was about 20% less the veterans who were treated in the VA than were treated in the private sector. So it's a myth that it saves money to have veterans referred to the private sector. It is, in my estimation, a giveaway to corporate health care. they spend a lot of money lobbying, and there's billions of dollars spent on VA healthcare, and they would like to have access to that. The veteran doesn't benefit, and I'll tell you why, because VA providers are constantly trained on veteran-centric issues. For example, a mental health provider is trained on combat-related PTSD, military sexual trauma, the number of, particularly women, but also men who've experienced sexual harassment and trauma in the military is extremely high. They're trained on recognizing the symptoms of exposure to toxic substances. This training is offered to providers in the community care program, but they're not required to take it. And a review of that by, I believe, the Congressional Budget Office, or maybe the Government Accounting Office, found that only 2% of providers in the community care program take this training. It's not mandatory. So they don't take the training. And to make some sense, if you have a panel of 100 patients and two or three are veterans, you don't want to spend time taking training on veterans' issues. But my position and the position of Save Our VA is, if you don't want to be trained on veterans' issues, you shouldn't be treating veterans. I mean, it's a promise the country makes to veterans to treat them for the things that are related to the military service. And if we're going to refer veterans to the private sector, we need to be sure that they're treated. Another problem with the private sector is about a third of private sector providers don't return medical records either at all or in timely fashion to the VA. So when the person goes back to the VA, the provider can't tell what's been done to them in the private sector to see whether what's being done is consistent, if there are contraindications for medications, if a test has already been done and doesn't need to be repeated to have the results. So it doesn't benefit the veterans in any way. It'll benefit them, those who are in remote areas who don't have, the VA can't provide that service. Let me give you an example. So I was an associate director of the VA hospital in Erie, Pennsylvania, a small equivalent to a community hospital. It made no sense for a small hospital like that to have a PET scan, for example. And so those services were contracted out to the local hospital, but the VA got back the medical records, or we often had what were called consultants who worked in the private sector, came to the VA hospital on a fee basis and provided services there. And that was a good arrangement. And nobody would argue that the VA should, in every case, should provide every service. In an area where it's a small hospital, it doesn't make economic sense to provide those services. And that has always been done. But now, veterans are referred to the private sector and the VA lose track of them. And then another study found that once the veteran gets into the private sector, they're likely to be exposed to more tests, to more medications and the like, because the VA has no control over what's happening to them. When you're a patient in the VA, if a primary care provider and you have a team who takes care of you and that primary care provider directs that care, so if you're talking to that person and he thinks you have social problems, he can refer you to a social worker who's part of that team. If you have psychological problems, you can see a psychologist, a psychiatrist. If you have cardiac problems, you can see a cardiologist. Another problem is, so I'll give you an example in my case. So I had bypass surgery September of 13. And of course, I knew that that could be related to exposure to Agent Orange. And I knew to file for a service-connected disability for that. But if a veteran sees a private provider who's not trained in this issue, he or she might not know to ask a question or to see by your record, I see you're in Vietnam, you have a cardiac problem. I see that you're in Vietnam, you have prostate cancer. And this may be related to Agent Orange. And so if they don't want to be trained in those things, they don't know to do that, and they don't have the kind of coordination. I don't know if you get your health care in the private sector, you know, you see your primary care provider, he or she refers you to a cardiologist. There's not much relationship between that cardiologist and the private provider. Then maybe he or she refers you to a rheumatologist. There's no coordination between the rheumatologist and the cardiologist unless you ask that your records be sent to these people so they can review them. In the VA, there's a centralized medical record. Any provider can see in that medical record in any place you go in the country is electronic medical record. If I'm on vacation in Florida and I have a heart incident and I go to a VA hospital there, my record is immediately available to whoever treats me there. So privatization doesn't really, on the whole, does not benefit veterans.
Yeah, when you talk about healthcare providers in the private sector not being trained on veterans' issues, I think about things like PTSD as a result of like sexual trauma or participation in war or burn pit exposure. I mean, if these people go to private providers, I could see where not many of them are going to be specializing in issues like that.
No, they won't. They don't have enough VA patients to make it worth their while. So here's a good example. So a veteran suffering from PTSD from combat experiences, he gets referred to a private provider and gets into group therapy. Most veterans are going to be very reluctant to share their experience in front of non-veterans. They feel they won't understand what it was like. They may have engaged in activities that now cause them to be awake at night, and it really plagued them because they wondered about whether it should have been done or not. They'd be much more likely to share that in a group of other veterans who've had that experience and understand it. But if they're in a group of non-veterans, I would be certainly reluctant to experience some of the things that I experienced in the military with non-veterans. So that's just one example of why it's good for veterans. And the VA is a community, so veterans come, they sit, they talk to other veterans, they find out about what's going on with them and whether they could get help in a certain area. That won't happen in the private sector. Mm-hmm. But most, not many people serve anymore. And most healthcare providers, unless they're veterans, don't understand the rigors of military service and don't really understand what a lot of veterans go through, especially those who are deployed to a combat zone.
So do you see this trend towards privatization changing at all under subsequent administrations at the federal level?
It could. If there are a lot of people in Congress who are really opposed to this and are really trying to defend veterans' rights, Representative Takano, Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Blumenthal, who's the ranking member of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, there are a lot of people that can, and a change in administration could help revert this. I'm worried so much damage will be done in the next 3 years that it'll be hard to reverse it.
That's Bruce Carruthers. He's with us today on A Better World, and we're talking about the VA healthcare system and other issues that Veterans for Peace is involved in. And you're listening to 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. What is it good for? Absolutely. Now, listen to me. Okay, that's Edwin Starr singing War from the album War and Peace. And our guest today on A Better World is Bruce Carruthers, member of the local chapter of Veterans for Peace. Bruce, are there different groups working on this issue of privatization?
There are. One of the major groups I mentioned before is Common Defense, which is a very large progressive veterans group, which has a high membership of post 9/11 veterans. Common Defense doesn't have chapter meetings the way American Legion and DAV does, but it's an online group, but they have weekly sit reps, situation reports. They have different groups like a climate justice group. They have a group that's dedicated to saving the VA. They've launched a major campaign, and their motto is the VA is not for sale. So they lobby congressmen, they're very involved in that. And Common Defense offers veterans training institutes where you can be trained in various things. I attended one in Pittsburgh, which is extremely well done. It's a highly organized and well-funded group. They have three paid people who work in North Carolina, for example. Vote Vets is another group that encourages veterans to vote, that has a progressive agenda. And they've also launched a campaign to stop privatization of the VA. Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans is another group that's involved in that. And I just became part of a group called Unite for Veterans, which is trying to form a coalition of all these various groups that oppose that. There's a Save Our VA campaign, Veterans for Peace. If people are interested in what's going on in veterans healthcare, the Veterans Healthcare Policy Institute is the most reliable source. It does analysis of legislation, analysis of healthcare trends. It submits statements for the record to congressional hearings and occasionally appears at the congressional hearings to give testimony. Unfortunately, the traditional veteran service organizations, the major ones, American Legion, Disabled American Veterans, Fortunes of Foreign Wars, have been a little silent in this campaign. For a long time, they've gone along with privatization. They're starting to become more alarmed about it, but they have not been strong advocates of anti-privatization. It has been newer groups, more non-traditional veterans groups, that have really taken the lead in opposing that. There is also a group called VA doctors, or doctors who work for the VA, who have lately become very active in opposing privatization. The United Nurses Union is also another organization that's been very active.
So how well, in your experience, does the VA at the national level listen to voices like yours and other groups or individuals who are advocating on behalf of the veteran?
They used to. I don't think they listen much anymore. One of the major groups they listen to is called Concerned Veterans for America. It's a group that was funded and backed by the Koch brothers. And it's not really a veterans organization. They don't have any chapters. It's really well-funded, and their whole mission has been to privatize the VA. They have the ear of the current administration of the VA as opposed to veterans groups, particularly these more progressive veterans groups I've mentioned. I want to mention one other thing, if I got just a minute. Besides providing health care to veterans, what most people don't realize is that the VA's research program is second only to the National Institutes of Health in its scope and its breadth. The VA was responsible for the pacemaker, for the shingles vaccine, for example. The VA has affiliations with almost all major medical schools, and 70% of all doctors receive some of their training at VA facilities. And there are large research programs at all of these facilities. I've worked, for example, at the VA in Colorado and the VA in Birmingham. And the VAs are built right on the same campus as the medical school hospitals. And so doctors in the VA and in the medical school work in both facilities, and they all have large research programs. And so the VA does research on veterans issues, but issues that benefit everybody. Prosthetics, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just veterans who lose a limb or need prosthetic devices. The VA has what's called a million veteran study. It is the largest study of a population that continues to get its care from one institution. So what can be traced over time is what sort of ailments they have, what are the factors that relate to these ailments, what age, ethnicity, race, for example. All those are things that benefit all Americans. And then lastly, the VA is the backup in the case of national emergencies. And those are things that the VA does that I think a lot of people are not aware of. So the VA is not just important to veterans, it's important to the healthcare system. The Association of Medical Colleges wrote a letter to Congress that said, if the VA is really undermined and the training program for healthcare professionals is undermined, it'll be devastating for medical schools.
I mean, if people are interested in this issue of privatization, think it does any good for them to contact people in Congress?
Oh, I think so. I think, you know, congressmen listen to that, and the more people that contact them, at the very minimum, with some who are in favor of this, it'll slow them down some. And those who are in favor of it will be able to say their constituents oppose privatization. So I think contacting your member of Congress is extremely important.
I read that one of the important purposes for Veterans for Peace is to seek justice for veterans. Do you see your work and the work of others on this privatization issue one of seeking justice for veterans?
Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, the way I look at it is when you enter the military, the U.S. made a promise to you that if you're harmed in the military, it will take care of you afterwards. And I think the VA healthcare system is a system that can best take care of veterans. So I think it provides justice for veterans. I think it provides just for veterans who are hurt in the service, for their families. You know, for example, so on veteran suicide is about twice the rate of civilian suicide. One of the programs that the VA has is contacting the family and trying to contact friends to let them know what to do in case of an emergency, how to talk somebody down, because research shows that a suicide is often an impulsive action. And if a person can be prevented from committing suicide at the time they're considering it, it's a very good likelihood that they won't in the future, that they'll get treatment. And so that's been the VA's approach to it. And while veteran suicide is extremely high, the VA's been more successful in addressing veteran suicide than the private sector has been. So yeah, I think it provides justice for veterans. And I think for future veterans, you know, for most of us, a lot of the ailments we suffer from military service don't suffer till later in life, like cardiac condition, prostate cancer. If the VA doesn't exist, doesn't research these things, doesn't keep track of it, current veterans will have nobody around who will know about these things and be an advocate for them.
So just got a couple of minutes left. What sorts of issues is the local Veterans for Peace chapter focused on these days?
The local Veterans for Peace chapter has been focused really on what's going on in Venezuela, what's going on with ICE, and what's going on in Palestine, both in Gaza and the West Bank. I mean, you know, this, from my opinion, the claim by the Israeli government that this is defending themselves, I don't think the level of destruction that's occurred in the Gaza Strip can be defended in any way. It's simply a defense. And since attention's been diverted from the West Bank, what's going on in the West Bank, the appropriation of land from Palestinians, it is destruction of their settlements, establishment of illegal settlements, all that. We have a member in Veterans for Peace who I know personally who gained his Israeli citizenship and has been in the West Bank several times. He got his Israeli citizenship so they couldn't kick him out. I mean, because he was a citizen. He sends a report from when he's there, and what he says in the videos he sent, what's going on there is really immoral and illegal. So those have been the things that the local chapter has been focusing on.
And if people want to find out more about you, about the VFP.
They can just, in any search engine, put Veteran for Peace, and it will show up, and they can click on it. And in there, if they want to know about Save Our VA, they can go under Programs, and they can click on Save Our VA, and they can see what we do. And if they're interested in these letters we write to members of Congress, they can sign up for our updates, which come out every 3 weeks. And there's almost everyone, there's a letter, what we call a call to action, that only takes a few minutes. All you have to do is just put in your personal information, and then it'll automatically send it to the appropriate congressman. If it's something that's in the House, it'll only go to the House. If it's in the Senate, it'll only go to the senators, your senators, the senators in this state.
Okay, we've come to the end of our time together, and I want to thank Bruce Carruthers from local chapter of Veterans for Peace, Western North Carolina. Thank you, Bruce, so much for coming on the show, and all the best to you.
It's been a pleasure, and I'm happy to come on any time you want to talk about veterans' issues.
I wish you peace.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. My name is McNair Ezard, and we hope to see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with I Wish You Peace from the Eagles from their album One of These Nights.
The lonely time. Arms to hold you when you're aching inside. I wish you hope things are going bad. wish you shelter from the